Welcome to this Friday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. On today's show, hear about some of the challenges and opportunities with harvest automation. And we continue the discussion from yesterday on true bug pests. Today, we talk about management strategies. It's all just ahead here on the My Ag Life Daily News Report.
Robotic harvesting has been technically feasible since the 1980s, and recent ongoing efforts have been driven by farm labor shortages, machine-friendlier crops, better, cheaper hardware, advances in algorithms, and abundance of R&D funding. Still, however, there are almost no commercial units available. UC Davis's Stavros Vouyoukas said that there are many challenges still with robotic harvesting, but that there's also opportunities, and that these both revolve around harvest efficiency and speed.
These two parameters define the harvesting cost. You know, we can build machines to harvest fruits, but unless they're cost effective, it doesn't make sense to use them. So the example is, if there is 100 fruits that can be picked on the tree, they're marketable. And if your machine only harvests 70 of them, then what, you know, the rest 30 of them is basically your profit, right? So you can have a machine that harvests only 70. Now, you could have a machine that harvests only 70%, but then you use people to harvest the rest 30%. That's definitely doable. And there have been some analyses for strawberry harvesting, for example, that try to come up with the economics, like, you know, what's the percentage that we should pick, assuming that we pay people to pick the rest and all of that stuff. But the bottom line is that these two numbers, the percentage of fruits you can pick, and then how much time you allocate to pick one fruit, those two define the harvesting cost, like cents per fruit, if you will. And that's why these are very important to meet, those numbers, those high numbers. But it's also very difficult. The difficulties come from different sources. A main source that affects the efficiency, how many fruits you can pick, is the visibility. Like if you look at a tree and you look at the fruits, maybe you see, even as a human, okay, there is 100 fruits there. But if you actually change your point of view, or you go closer, or you enter into the canopy, you might see another 20 or 30 that you didn't see before because of occlusions, foliage, branches, other fruits. So visibility is extremely important. You can't pick something unless you see it. And visibility is restricted by biology, by the tree itself. Increasing visibility and efficiency can be done partially through technology and partially through breeding different varieties or horticultural practices of pruning and de-leafing and thinning to make things more visible.
Speed of harvest has also been proven to be a limiting factor in harvest automation due to the fact that most of the time spent picking fruits in fields or orchards comes from going towards and away from the fruit, i.e. reaching in and coming back out.
If you have to travel a longer distance because fruits are deep inside the canopy, or if you have to go around branches and bypass obstacles, that makes it computationally, algorithmically more difficult, but also more time consuming. If you have a worker working on a platform picking apples, they take about one apple per second and a half. So they can pick that fast. Even the best robots like Abundant Robotics, they claimed they could harvest one apple per second. I don't know if it's true. I mean, maybe their peak rate was that. Not sure if it was the average rate, but you can still see one high-tech arm could maybe, in the best case, substitute one person. But when you harvest, you have a crew of 100 people, right? So how do you replace then those 100 people unless you make robots much faster, with multiple arms, you know, different designs. So the speed is limited, by biology, by also by technology and design, mechanical design system. But again, you need to be fast and you need to be efficient to have low cost.
In reality, the only reason the industry is able to adopt harvest automation these days is because biology of plants are changing, such as those of apples.
If those trees were still 1950s trees, you know, big and round and huge, there is no way you could build cost-effective robots. So that already tells you that biology and horticulture need to invest in varieties that are smaller, like smaller trees, more compact. And then, you know, maybe cultivars where you don't have as much clustering. For example, I believe for peppers, sweet peppers, they've come up with varieties where the peppers are not as clustered. So you don't have like 3-4 peppers together, because that makes it very difficult for perception systems and robots to find them and grab them. And even if you grab one, maybe two of them drop down. And so you wasted two peppers to grab one, right? The same with fruits. So we have to advance on that side. And that side, the inertia is larger. It takes more time to breed new varieties and to breed for harvesting, if you will.
On the technology side, as far as opportunities go, advances need to be made to each part of the entire system.
You may have an arm that's ultra fast and picks fast, but how do you convey that fruit to the bee? If that system, the conveyance system, is not optimized to work together with the arm, then it may be your bottleneck, right? So it has to do with the overall design of the machine and also the individual technology. For example, for sure, machine learning technologies enable us now to find, detect the fruits, even if they're visible partially. A few years back, that wasn't possible. Now, even if you see maybe half of the fruit or a third of the fruit, you can say, oh, there's a fruit there, because of all these, you know, machine learning new algorithms that are trained and can be very, very good. That was already an advancement that helped things out. Advancements also in algorithms, control algorithms, actuation, like how do you grab a fruit? For example, it's possible to have a vacuum, like one of the companies used a vacuum to grab a fruit, an apple, and pull it and detach it. But some apple varieties, you actually need to clip the stem after you harvest it. So you can't harvest those apples with those machines. Now, maybe we abandon fruit that can't be harvested mechanically in the future. It's very possible. But these are, you know, the challenges. So technology needs to advance also in different fronts: algorithms, actuators, materials, overall system design.
The other issue right now with automated harvesters is that many of them haven't made it to the commercial market. Viuca said if the right harvester meets the right crop and for the right demand, then it will become commercial. However, there's a couple questions to ask. Will the grower be purchasing and investing in the technology, or will they be purchasing a service?
Most likely, and most companies are oriented toward the robotics as a service model. So we come to your field, we harvest, and you pay us so many cents per fruit or so many dollars per ton. In that case, the farmer doesn't need to invest in the technology or buy it. You don't need to have a huge network of dealers and shops where if my robot has a problem, I bring it to you so you fix it, right? So that would simplify things in terms of deployment and adoption. But the challenges there are that if those robots are only good to harvest, say, apples, then you need to start deploying them in California in, I don't know, September, but then you need to move them up towards Washington State and harvest later. And then at some point, harvest is done, first of all. So there is a limited window. Are you transporting those robots then to the southern hemisphere to harvest there? It's probably expensive. What I'm saying is that you may have a machine that can be only used for 2 months a year. That can be a big problem, right? The other is demand. If everybody wants to harvest in the same harvesting window, which is typically the case, and everybody needs those machines, how many have you have in stock in order to satisfy this huge demand? Do you have 1,000 machines in stock? So these are challenges that relate more to what is the cost of the machine, how many are needed actually to do the task, and are they multi-purpose? Can you repurpose them for different fruits? So far, that hasn't been the case.
We'll be right back with our next segment after this short break.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Yesterday, UCCE Area IPM Advisor Jalendra Rajal explained monitoring strategies for Hemipteran true bug pests in the spring, with many novel strategies being available. However, the same is not necessarily the case for management of these true bugs. In fact, due to limited active ingredients available on the market and legally registered, growers only have a few pyrethroids for true bug pests in almond and pistachio.
So if you think about the management of these all hemipteran pests, we wanted to have a available insecticide and we can use it, but we have very limited active ingredient present. So we have majority of the cases for all of these stink bug or leaf-footed bug or the smaller hemipteran pests that we talk about across almonds and pistachio, we only have few pyrethroid insecticide available. And when we talked about the concern in the early part of the season, and when you use the pyrethroid, you can imagine, right, we all can know that can flare up the mite population with the pyrethroid use. That is one of the tools that is available, but also has a concern.
Some other active ingredients are available for true bug control in almond and pistachio. However, they're not as hard hitting.
So we do have some of the other, like for example, clothianidin is one of the belay, which is relatively softer, and that can be used as an alternative to pyrethroid. Of course, when you have the huge, big population, that belay may not be effective to completely control the pest. But if you are seeing the light population, that could be the alternative insecticide that we can use. And we're hoping that to continue doing this stink bug or leaf-footed bug hemipteran control research and try to find some of the other alternative also, but that research is ongoing, and at this point we don't have any much alternative, because stink bug and leaf-footed bug control is really difficult because they need a contact insecticide and relatively stronger ones, which there are limited active ingredient available at this point. So yeah, in terms of the managing this pest, other than the continuing doing the IPM practices, looking at the visual monitoring, and then if you need to, there are some insecticide that are effective available, but they are limited in terms of active ingredient.
A look at regional agricultural news coming up right after this word from our sponsor. You're listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
In regional agricultural news today, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service has confirmed the presence of citrus canker disease in a nursery in South Carolina. The nursery sells plants to consumers through online sales, including four locations in California since August of 2021. Retail nurseries did not receive these plants. Citrus canker causes citrus leaves and fruit to drop prematurely and results in lesions on citrus leaves, stems, and fruit. Fruit infected with a bacterium that causes citrus canker is safe to eat, but it may not be marketable because of the lesions. The disease affects all citrus varieties. Citrus canker is not harmful to people or animals. Napa Green is now the first wine growing certification program in the world to redevelop and overhaul their sustainability standards. The organization's new model, called the Napa Green Vineyard Program, officially replaced the Napa Greenland Program on January 1st, and the 42 members transitioning will have a year to adapt to the new regulations. According to Napa Green's executive director, Anna Britton, these 42 participants represent about 5,200 vineyards. About 5,200 vineyard acres in the Napa Valley area. At the basic level, the revised Napa Green Vineyard Program looks at issues that were not at the forefront of the certification when the first version was drafted, most notably including climate action, regenerative farming, and social equity. As a result, the program now has six main elements, which include conservation burning, tree and forest prevention, restricted pesticides, water efficiency, carbon farming, and inclusion, each of which has a set of mandatory and optional actions to take to meet certification standards. The action plan consists of tangible changes that the vineyard crews can make, whether it be infrastructurally, administrative, or mental. Such items include implementing annual performance reviews for staff, hiring farm workers year-round rather than seasonally, installing flow meters to track water use, replanting with drought-tolerant rootstocks, and many, many more. St. Helena Winery Wheeler Farms has announced a new leadership team, including Philip O'Connor as general manager, Tom Harder as executive chef, and Emily Bowler as curator of gardens and farm ambassador. O'Connor has worked in restaurants, hotels, and wineries in Europe and in the U.S., including in California. Harder oversees the culinary program at the winery. He has worked at restaurants in Napa Valley, and Bowler founded Small Table Farms after serving as the pastry chef in San Francisco. While the business of protecting intellectual property recently got some shiny new tools, many of the challenges behind the disputes between vendors about trademarks remain the same. The Trademark Modernization Act of 2020 called for the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to develop ways to streamline the dispute process and clean up fraudulent and unused marks. Those rules took effect in December. A key update was the allowance of third parties to undertake cancellation of marks not in use through expungement and re-examination proceedings. Those are key because it is more difficult for legitimate businesses to clear and register their own marks, according to the final rule. Warren Dranet, an intellectual property attorney with Santa Rosa-based Spalding, McCulley, and Tansel, explains the difficulty created by such unused marks as saying, if a winery wants to introduce a new brand or mark, but one is out there standing in the way, you can't go forward. Then records have to be evaluated to determine if they warrant further inquiry. From that point, the one that registered the mark would have to prove evidence that it actually was in use to maintain that registration. An improvement that came with the signing of the Trademark Modernization Act was a presumption of the irreparable harm when there was a court finding of infringement. Before that, if a mark enforcement action was headed towards litigation, a goal was to get a preliminary injunction as quickly as possible. Another new rule that kicked in around the end of last year was a halving of the time the applicants or registrants have to respond to agency action, reducing it to 3 months from 6. Online grocery shopping has become a major category for online sales, according to a recent report by Adobe Digital Insights. The report marked 2020 as the breakout year for retail grocery sales, which increased 101% over 2019, largely because of the pandemic. It accounted for 9.1% of online sales that year, up from 6.3% in 2019. For 2021, grocery accounted for 8.9% of online sales. Consumers now spend an average of $6.7 billion each month for groceries, which is over double the pre-pandemic level of $3.1 billion per month. E-commerce is being reshaped by grocery shopping, a category with minimal discounting compared to legacy categories like electronics and apparel, according to Patrick Brown, Vice President of Growth Marketing and Insights for Adobe. It highlights a shift in a digital economy where speed and convenience are becoming just as important as cost savings. Curbside pickup accounted for 20% of all online sales, according to the report. Total online sales in 2020 were at $818.8 billion, up over 41%, over $574.9 billion in 2019. The year-over-year increase for 2021 was smaller at $885 billion, or 8.9%. The analysts expect total online sales to be more than $1 trillion in 2022. Inflation accounted for a portion of the increase in dollar value for online sales. In 2021, $22 billion of growth in e-commerce was due to inflation, and that's up $4.7 billion in 2020. Adobe expects the value of online grocery purchases for 2022 to be 8.5% of all purchases. In short, it would seem that the online grocery purchases are likely to reach a stable 8 to 10% of all e-commerce in the near term. As e-commerce continues to grow, one could expect online grocery figures to increase accordingly. How much of those increases will be due to inflation is a question that has yet to be answered.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission. Delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
Elaine Trevino, the Biden administration nominee to serve as chief ag negotiator, will take a non-political appointment in the administration. As a result, the White House withdrew her nomination to the trade post at the U.S. Trade Representative's office. Farm groups welcomed her nomination last year, noting the work needed in agriculture trade. At the time, the American Farm Bureau Federation President Zippy Duvall said opportunities to create new trade agreements with the European Union and Great Britain, as well as expanding a China Phase 1 agreement, make filling this position with the most qualified person extremely important. Trevino recently served as president of the Almond Alliance of California and previously served as deputy secretary at the California Department of Food and Agriculture. The Organic Industry State of Organic Seeds report shows no meaningful improvement in organic producers using more organic seed compared to 5 years ago. The report announced this week, along with a National Organic Research Agenda, concludes the lack of progress puts at risk the viability of the organic seed industry and the integrity of the organic label. Released by the Organic Farming Research Foundation and the Organic Seed Alliance, the reports are published every 5 years to examine organic farming challenges across the United States. In 2019, the organizations were jointly awarded with funding from USA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture's Organic Research and Extension Initiative for the research projects. The organic food market experienced incredible growth in 2020, with sales surpassing $56 billion, a 12% increase from 2019. The organic seed market has also grown in recent years due to demand for organic food, as well as a dramatic rise in gardening during the COVID-19 pandemic. The joint membership of four equipment dealer associations voted overwhelmingly in favor of moving forward with a merger to create the new North American Equipment Dealers Association. The organizations include the Midwest Southeastern Equipment Dealers Association, the United Equipment Dealers Association, the Western Equipment Dealers Association, and the Equipment Dealers Association. The member vote was the final step of the merger process to create the new Association of Equipment Dealers. A spokesperson for the working group overseeing the vote states that a major reason for proceeding with this merger is that their members will benefit from a larger, financially strong association that will provide more services. The newly formed North American Equipment Dealers Association will continue to represent dealers on a national basis with manufacturer relations and in federal government affairs in Ottawa and in Washington, D.C. The organization will also continue to represent dealers in their 24 U.S. state capitals and 9 Canadian provinces. The United States, the agriculture, Secretary of Agriculture, and the world are watching events in Ukraine closely to monitor the nation's ability to produce farm goods and exports to markets with a focus on food security. USDA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
A recent meeting between the G7 agricultural ministers, one with participation from the European Ag Commissioner and various world food security and aid programs, was convened in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack participated in the meeting.
During the course of that opportunity, we had a chance to hear from the Ukrainian agriculture minister, Lyshenko. He was obviously in a bunker surrounded by sandbags, and I thought to myself, what incredible courage it takes for him to visit with us, to plead with us for support and help.
A statement was issued after the meeting by the G7 ag ministers condemning the invasion, including the targeting of critical agricultural infrastructure and pledging shared commitments in several areas, ranging from safeguarding global food security and nutrition to monitoring markets to assure full transparency of food systems. Secretary Vilsack said some other takeaways from his visit with the Ukrainian ag minister include.
I think he underscored the desire and the will on the part of Ukrainian farmers to be able to plant this spring and this summer. And what they need is fuel that's now being used in military applications, would have been used in farming applications. So he is requesting primarily from European countries additional fuel supplies. That was his single ask.
As well as a notice to the G7 nations and the globe.
That we need to make sure that we do everything we possibly can to provide as much stability in the marketplace as we can. Stability is important because at the early stages of a situation like this, there is a lot of speculation, and speculation can lead to people making decisions or judgments that may not be based on what's going on the ground, maybe based on what they think may happen.
To that regard, Secretary Vilsack says our nation is focusing on traditional Ukrainian export markets, particularly developing countries that could face market disruption.
We know where they have been historically exporting, to the Middle East, to North Africa, and to China. We know that some of those countries are very dependent on what they get from the Ukraine, so we have to make sure that we focus on this. We make sure that if those countries need help and can't get it from Ukraine, that we're in a position to help and provide assistance. So we're focusing on the programs at USDA that would provide that assistance.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Clean Water Act has fallen far short of its original goals to have 100% of waters fishable and swimmable by 1983, and a report by the Environmental Integrity Project calls for the elimination of agricultural exemptions from the CWA as part of the fix. For years, farmers and ranchers have had many agriculture practices exempt from the CWA, essentially counting ag runoff as non-point sources of pollution. Congress should strengthen the Clean Water Act by closing its loophole for agricultural runoff and other non-point sources of pollution, which by far is the largest sources of impairments in waterways across the U.S., according to the Environmental Integrity Project report. Factory-style animal production has become an industry with massive waste disposal problems and should be regulated like other large industries, according to the report. In addition, the Environmental Integrity Project calls for changes to the law to give government agencies more power to more strongly enforce so-called pollution diets imposed by total maximum daily loads. The Biden administration currently is rewriting definitions of waters in the U.S., and farm and other groups have raised concerns about the possibility of agriculture losing some of its longstanding CWA exemptions. The Environmental Integrity Project is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group of former EPA enforcement attorneys that advocate for enforcement of environmental laws. That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.